story of something I sat on.
Okay.
This one might have been said. I caught the show, like, halfway through. But, and I'm sure it's been done, like, tons of people have had this happen to them. But I'll give you a very quick version. Middle school, lunch period, chocolate pudding on a chair. Uh-oh, looks like I pooped my pants.
I like it.
I didn't like it so much.
I like it.
Would you like it now?
Yes.
Would you like it if it happened to you?
Yes.
On the subway?
Yes.
If you sat on that on the subway?
Yes.
I think you might be lying.
No.
How can I say that? How can I even say that?
Have a good one, mister.
Bye-bye.
Oh, Frangu, you're playing Fast and Loose with the Truth tonight.
FMU, you're on the air.
Oh, hey, guys. How you doing?
Hi.
My name's Frank. I'm a pizza delivery guy. I'm kind of a long-time listener, but never called.
Really?
Well, welcome, Frank.
I know. I always miss your show because I'm so busy delivering pizza and all that.
Right,
know?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you're pizza delivery guy number 5, I think, by our count.
Oh, man.
Okay.
Well, you're our favorite.
Well, we're popular with pizza delivery guys. What can I say?
Yeah, you know, I just wanted to call and also say you guys are saying you love that guy's voice so much. It was definitely a fake Louisiana accent.
I don't care. It was still good.
it wasn't that good, though.
I like fake. Right. Fake is good.
I don't even know. I was so skeptical of Gladys Clotworthy once upon a time.
And she's real.
Yeah, we proved her existence.
So, mister, have you ever sat on a pie?
A pizza? No, I dropped a couple pies.
What have you sat on?
Oh, well, I was young, and we were having, like, a sleepover. It's not that great of a story, and it's not gross, don't worry. But my friend was sleeping on the couch, this chick who I had, like, you know, schoolboy crush on. But she was asleep on the couch. We were all playing video games and getting, like, rowdy. And I sat on her head by mistake because I didn't even think and sat down really quick. And I got up like, oh, my God, oh, my God. She was still asleep, though. It was fine.
So she doesn't know to this day that you sat on her head?
To this day, and she lives in Vermont, so I don't think she's listening.
She might be.
We have at least one listener in Vermont.
I forgot she was back there, and then I did it again, and she still didn't wake up.
So twice you sat on somebody's head accidentally.
Yeah. In the same night, same, like, 5 minutes.
I don't know. That's if it happens twice, it's not coincidence anymore.
Yeah, I might be trying.
Maybe that's your thing, you perv.
Subconsciously.
Yeah, that's me. You know me all too well.
All right, thanks for calling. Have a good one.
No problem. I'll call soon.
Head
Scarlett's
city.
Talking about that dude who died. What's his name? Ryan? Ryan Dunn?
Ryan Dunn?
She goes, ironic. Wait, where is it? Hold on, because it's kind of good. I like that comment.
They found him with car parts yeah. in his ass. How ironic. I don't know if that's true.
No, it's not. It's a joke.
Oh, okay.
Jesus. Ken says he's disqualified because he's station manager.
How do you know that's really Ken posting on the comments board?
Oh, I don't know.
He'll be here when we get off the air.
We can ask
him.
He'll be here in like a minute. FMU, you're on the air.
Hello, Frangry. Hello, Andy. It's the Pizza Poltergeist.
Hello, hi. Pizza Poltergeist.
How are you?
Very good. How are
pizza
you?
Pizza delivery guy number one.
Very good. Very, very good. I just wanted to let you know that in honor of your topic, I sat on a pizza and I just convinced my boss to eat a pizza.
I need a photo.
I can get you a photo. There's hair and everything.
Email me a photo at frangry@gmail.com.
Absolutely.
Okay. Hold on. So your boss ate butt pizza?
He ate butt pizza. He does not know. I'm sitting out in my car snickering.
I love this. Okay, thanks for calling, PP. That's his
Goodbye.
New name, PP.
Pizza Poltergeist.
Yeah. Call us 201-209-9368. Stuff you've sat on.
You know who never sits on anything?
Who?
Our arboreal ancestors who are ape-like.
They don't
It's
sit?
Only because we stand upright that we ever have to sit down. So if you're
if
you're scrambling
all the time,
around on all fours like an ape, then you don't need to sit down so much.
Everyone thinks Ken was lying.
Well,
Ken wouldn't lie. Why would he embarrass himself like that?
Maybe that's the perfect alibi. Nobody would believe me if I told that story.
I don't think Ken wants everyone to know that he got raped by a chair.
Or a funnel. I don't know.
At least he wasn't a girl and it didn't land in the other.
Like, at least he didn't have a Linda Blair experience, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Call us 201-209-9368.
Wait, I did see that movie with Linda Blair.
Kinda over the show. Okay, stuff you've sat on.
Someone predicted that would happen 5 minutes in.
I know, but it took 57 minutes.
Yeah.
Come on, that's pretty good. That's like a world record. We did make history tonight.
I need to prepare my closing remarks. That's how long we've gone.
All right, I think I'm going to give the prize to your wife.
Really? Congratulations,
Beth. Strawberry
Beth.
Underwear? That's so cute.
But it's something that happened like 30 years ago.
I don't care. There's no time limit.
Okay. There's no statute of limitations on fruit-stained underwear?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, Beth, you're my winner. I will send a T-shirt home with Andy.
Okay.
Wait, we're done already?
Can I have one too? I'm gonna bring up the music. I'm gonna pot up the music, as we call it.
We have a call. FMU, you're on the radio.
Hey, what's up? Things you sat on?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, the one time me and my wife and we went out to dinner, she wanted me to hold onto her pocketbook for her. So, the chair I was sitting on was in the sturdiest of chairs. So I threw my feet forward, I took her pocketbook, and I swung around underneath me, and the chair gave way.
And you fell.
And, well, yeah, I fell, but the worst thing was that I sat right on her pocketbook, and I broke her glasses.
Oh, no.
Extreme sitting!
Woo-hoo! Thanks for calling. Have a good one. Scarlett says, next week's topic, vaginal insertion.
Why not? No, we have a good body-related topic for next week,
don't we? I don't know if we're doing it.
Oh, it's a good one.
We'll see.
Okay, we should wrap up the show. You've been listening to Shut Up Weirdo. You can comment during the show at WFMU.org. You can visit our website, shutupweirdo.com, which has videos of extreme sitting and hopefully some other good stuff in the near future. It's also got links to our Facebook page, Twitter, and iTunes, our archive. I'm Andy.
I'm Fran Greek.
You are listening to the great one, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, live and archived at WFMU.org. So let's
end it here.
time for Josh and Chuck and Stuff You Should Know, the program that blows your mind on a weekly basis with astonishing facts from around the world. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, Josh and Chuck explore the world of parkour and free running. And then in part two, they look at how nuclear meltdowns work. Now here's Josh and Chuck.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuck Bryant. And we are going to sit still for this episode of Stuff You Should Know.
Not me, buddy.
Yes, you are.
I'm going to do some Kong vaulting.
Hey, Chuck, you watch The Office, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Love it.
In season 6, which I guess was last year.
Okay.
Second episode.
Yeah.
Starts out very funny. with Michael, Andy, and Dwight all engaged in a little something called parkour.
Yeah.
And they shout parkour like every couple of seconds,
right? Of course they do.
And then what struck me as funny, especially after we decided to do this episode, mm-hmm. is that Jim explains what parkour is for anybody who doesn't know.
Yeah.
And he cites it as the internet sensation of 2004. So it took, you know, Michael right. 6 years to finally catch on to it.
What's up?
It's taking us 7 to finally start podcasting on it.
Yes.
Yeah.
We've been had calls for this one since we started the show. People have written in and said, what about parkour, dude?
Yeah.
I love it.
Parkour.
And we know it's old.
Yeah.
So we're not. But, we've not just discovered this.
It's in this article clearly has been on the site since about 2006 or 7.
Yeah,
because there's actually a date cited in it as like 2006. And from the extra research that we did on this, it seems like this community has strengthened, expanded, and gotten more legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, I'm sure with a lot of the rest of the world, it's like the awe and amazement of it or the newness is worn off. But I was heartened to see that the people who do parkour are like, well, we don't really care if you like it or not. We're going to keep doing this. And they've grown and gotten better.
Yeah, I think most people that I know have the same reaction, though, when they see the parkour videos for the first time, which is, this is pretty cool.
Oh, it's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying like anybody's like,
no.
This sucks.
It's, no, I knew that.
Like the newness is worn off for the general public.
Yeah, but people are generally knocked out and then bored.
Right. So, Chuck.
Yes.
I think we should begin, right?
Great song.
In 1902, on a little island in the Caribbean known as Martinique.
You ever been there?
No.
Yeah, me neither.
Don't you think I would tell you every couple of days, like, oh, I've been to Martinique?
Yeah, you probably would. Yeah, it's got a pretty interesting history. In some trace, the birth of parkour back to then. A French naval officer named Lieutenant George Herbert.
I don't think that's how you say his name.
What would you say in French?
Georges Hébert.
Georges Hébert. What happened was a volcano blew up in 1902 there, and he coordinated...
In Martinique.
Yeah, in Martinique. He coordinated the rescue of locals and Europeans there and had a chance to watch people fleeing this and saw a decided difference, I take it, between some of his European comrades and the local Caribbeans.
Well, people were like trying to get around obstacles, like, you know, chunks of flying rock that had landed
yeah.
right in front of them and running for their lives. Something about that scene struck Hébert like, wow, this is really amazing.
Well, he saw a great deal of athleticism going on
yeah.
around him, and he said, you know what? You combine that with some courage, and what you have is what we're going to call in America to be strong and useful. How would you say that in French, Josh?
Strong and useful.
Être fort pour être. Très utile.
That's nice.
What I'm saying.
And that's the basis of the natural method, right?
Yeah, the natural method, which in French would be, what, method naturel?
Sure.
And that inspired French military training. That became the basis for French military training. Apparently, they were the first people to use obstacle courses.
Or
what, the path of the warrior, parkour de combattant?
Yeah.
So you hear that word parkour with a C.
I heard it.
That's where it came from.
Yeah. So, and this guy is like this French physical fitness guru that you've never heard of, but really has inspired a lot of the probably cleaner cut quarters of France, right?
Yes.
So that formed the part of the basis for the philosophy of what came to be known as parkour, because it inspired this kid named David Bell, right?
Well, first it was his father, Raymond Bell, was a soldier in French Special Forces.
Okay.
He learned all this stuff, passed it on to his son, David, and said, it's pretty cool. You might want to learn this.
Yeah, and we left out a very important point. The natural method is basically like physical fitness.
Uh-huh.
Is all you need is what you find in nature. So you want to do some chin-ups? Go find a tree branch, jerk.
Yeah.
You want to like work out your upper body? Push a huge rock up a hill.
Yeah, or isometrics, you know, push against a wall.
Right, and then the point of that, this is the other big point, the point of being physically fit is, like you said, so you can be useful to society.
Yeah.
In case of an emergency,
mm-hmm.
in case an old lady needs help. Like, you can pick her up and carry her across the street with yeah. one hand, that kind of thing.
There's something to be said for that.
Okay, so David Bell is 15 years old. It's 1988. He lives in Lises, France, which is a suburb of Paris.
Mm-hmm.
And his dad's been like, check this dude out. And he is just inspired.
Yeah.
By not only Hebert, but also a guy named Bruce Lee.
That's right. Bruce Lee's fluid movements. Not as rigid as a lot of martial artists were before him.
It was about adaptability, adapting to the situation.
Yeah, sure.
Somewhere in that, in David Bell's brain, he put that together. He put Bruce Lee, Georges Hebert,
mm-hmm.
and a mailbox in front of him
yeah.
all together and decided to leap over it with his hands rather than walk around it.
Boom, parkour.
That's parkour.
He added a K instead of a C.
Yep.
Got together with his best buddy, Sebastian Foucan,
mm-hmm.
and they established a group. They were called themselves Tresseurs.
Which, Tresseur means to leave a trail in French.
Okay.
Tresseur is slang in Paris for hurry.
Well, there you have it.
Yeah.
Hurry up and make a trail.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. So they organized a group, the first group of parkour enthusiasts, basically called the Yamakaze,
mm-hmm.
not to be confused with Yamazaki, which is Suntory time. It's Japanese single malt whiskey.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
So anyway.
I had it in an Okonomiyaki station.
Chances are if you type in Yamakaze on the internet, it'll bring up the other Yamazaki, and you'll be buying liquor before you know it.
Right. And then you can watch some cool parkour videos while you imbibe.
That's right. Luc Besson, famous French filmmaker, made a film called The Yamakaze. Definitely kicked up the awareness about what parkour was.
Right, and prior to that, he included it in his film Taxi 2.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, so that was the first time parkour was introduced to the general public in mass media. And because Luc Besson apparently was a huge devotee very early on. So in two different movies, in two successive years,
mm-hmm.
he made parkour part of the theme.
Yeah, and if you recognize Bell's buddy's name, Sebastian Foucan, he was the dude who was chased in Casino Royale, the opening yeah. awesome parkour chase.
Yeah.
That Daniel Craig chases this dude.
Yeah. So it starts to kind of percolate into to the public consciousness in the early 2000s. The late 90s, we should say, by the late 90s, there was already a rift in the parkour community.
Yeah, the communities like this always like to battle. Like, there's always purists, it seemed like, and then people who want to change it and take it into what they feel like is the next level.
Right.
Like skateboarding, same thing happened back in the 70s.
So with parkour, the point is, if you're a purist with parkour,
mm-hmm.
you never move backwards. Everything is for utility,
mm-hmm.
and you get from point A to point B most as efficiently as possible, which often includes jumping over a mailbox.
Yeah, the main rule, and this is what's cool in parkour, is that obstacles are used to increase your efficiency.
Yes.
So it's not like, this is something I got to go around. It's let me use this to vault forward faster.
And possibly gain some momentum, maybe
yeah.
trade a little kinetic energy for a little potential energy.
Yeah.
And then turn that into more kinetic energy.
Uh-huh. And
then drink a few Red Bulls.
Well, Red Bull actually sponsored one of the...
Yeah.
What was it called? The Red Bull Art of Motion tournament.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a competition.
Yeah.
And we'll get into that in a minute because the purists don't like the competition aspect. But the motto of the WFPF, which is the World Free Running and Parkour Federation, I think that was established in 07, it is no obstacle, no freedom, K-N-O-W for both. Get it?
I do now.
If you
I
know
didn't until you told me about the K.
You know your freedom. Cool.
So that's so parkour A to B, using obstacles, never going backwards. Free running, huge, huge difference. You can go backwards.
Now, going backwards, does that mean like you? I get the idea from parkour is that you're running toward the wall and you don't stop and go, all right, let me see. I should probably go like here. You just attack the wall, don't you?
I think that's the case with both of them.
Uh-huh.
But really, honestly, one of the main differences is like free running allows for movement backward to continue going forward, where parkour is like, no, you have to keep going forward all the time.
And free running also allows for movements that are purely aesthetic in nature,
yes.
Right? And not necessarily just the efficiency of moving forward.
Right. Those are the two differences between free running and parkour. And
also known as flair.
If you think that's stupid, well, the reason behind it is that there was a rift or a separation in ideals between David Bell and his as the FP wait what is it WFPW WFPF
yeah
as the WFPF puts it his then best friend Sebastian Foucan.
Yeah, they fell out, I guess.
I think they're still buddies, but basically Foucan's like, no, you can move backwards, and Bell's like, no, you can't. And they were like, well, it looks like we have a problem here.
Probably,
and that's where free running came from. It split off from parkour.
I bet you there was a little bit of, I founded it, and you were in Casino Royale.
Well, that came after. So that split was in the late 90s.
So that really cemented it then.
Yeah. And then a lot of people are like, you know, Foucan is a big sellout. He's in ads. He's just all flash and everything. And that apparently that argument doesn't hold much water because David Bell has done quite a bit to bring parkour into the public consciousness. Specifically, he introduced it to Britain in 2002, I believe, right? With a BBC short?
Yeah, Rush Hour. Did you see it?
Huh.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's, you know, he's sitting, it's very much like an ad. He's sitting in his apartment in his clothes, and then he gets up, you know, and takes his shirt off, of course, and strips down to the running pants, and then just climbs out his window and takes off, and there's, you know, traffic going below, and he's zipping all over the place like a, you know, parkour expert that he is.
Right.
And then he eventually gets back in his apartment and sits back down on the couch and is like, yeah, I'm done.
And so they showed that on BBC One and everybody was like, what was that?
Yeah.
That was awesome. And then they found out, well, wait a minute, the people actually do this. This guy is real. And that was the birth of parkour. I think a year later, Urban Free Flow, which is like the de facto British wing of parkour and free running.
Mm-hmm.
Free running? And for some reason, my brain just glitched, and I was like, that's not right.
Well, and almost immediately, kids started getting hurt because they didn't, I don't know if they didn't realize, but Bell had a decade of training of learning this craft.
Or creating it.
Creating it, and then teenagers saw Rush Hour and like, oh, let me go out and like, let me try to scale a wall. And there were a couple of deaths. There was one recently, actually, in California, right?
In Sacramento in 2009, kid was into parkour, and he died from falling off of an 8-story parking deck.
Yeah, and this is, we should have front-loaded this, but this is where we say parkour can be very dangerous if you don't know what you're doing.
I think it can be very dangerous even if you do know what
you're doing. Yeah, it requires a high degree of skill with, like, gymnastics, possibly martial arts.
Yeah, yeah, if you look at Sebastian Foucan, the dude is ripped.
Yeah.
Like, he's probably going to be able to hang on to a ledge with one hand if he really needs to.
I can't.
The average 12-year-old doesn't have that kind of upper body strength.
Exactly.
But the average 12-year-old's the one who's, like, really fascinated with this.
Yeah, and if you are fascinated, and there are a lot more, it's been legitimized to the extent that there are a lot more training facilities, indoor, padded things where you can practice this kind of thing. So you don't just go out and hit the streets and start jumping off of buildings.
That's right.
We would not advise that.
No.
All right.
So, Chuck, there's I think in the public imagination, there's a lot of comparisons with skateboarding, right? Well, there's kids like they're right there in front of the courthouse, so and they're skateboarding and they're not using a skateboard, but they like to be doing the same thing. Apparently, especially parkour purists.
Mm-hmm.
Find this very very offensive.
That's not offensive. I see a lot of similarities.
I don't think it's offensive either.
Using buildings, you know, same deal.
They're basically like, no, skateboarders are bad kids. We're good kids.
Right.
We're doing this so we can be useful to society when the time comes.
Yeah. Yeah. Skateboarders are great kids.
Agreed.
And Josh, like skateboarding in the 70s, once the popularity increased, it started to be thrown or prostituted, if you will, onto like ads and TV shows and corporate events. They listed that. I did not know corporate events hired parkour people.
Corporate event. If you got enough money, you do everything.
Okay.
There's this great show of Bruce Hornsby playing for the Fujitsu Corporation's like Christmas party. And it's awesome. It's like an hour and a half long Bruce Hornsby show, and he gets increasingly drunker to where like he does a little ditty, an improv ditty about his scotch.
Really?
Yeah, it's really great. It's really great. If you can ever get your hands on that bootleg, it's worth it.
Well, and then Up in the Air, which I know you didn't care for, but the when they had hired Young MC for that one corporate event to perform, that was pretty funny. Yeah. Bust a move. All right. Yes, like skateboard. Also, like skateboarding, once competition started to be mentioned, purists said, no, 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 no. It's not about competition. We compete all the time against each other on the streets, man.
Yeah.
But we don't need no medal. We don't need no judge.
Word.
But, you know, like anything.
Red Bull was like, oh, you know, what about this stack of money?
Red Bull and Barclay World Free Running Championships. MTV has a show now, of course, called Ultimate Parkour Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
The purists still aren't too happy about most of that, to be honest. There's a lot of complaining going on parkour boards.
And here we are, representing both coasts, east and west.
That's right. Let's talk about the moves.
Let's do it. You want to talk about the cat leap first?
Yeah, there's a few standard moves.
So the cat leap is basically like, say you're, close your eyes, unless you're driving right now. Say you are on the edge of 1 5-foot parking deck.
Okay.
All right, it's 5 feet off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another, there's a gap, a 5-foot gap in between it and the edge of another parking deck, which is 7 feet off the ground.
Yeah, there's a wall in front of you.
So let's say you are, you're like, well, I think a cat leap would be best for this. What you do is you run off of the first parking deck, jump the gap, grab the ledge of the second parking deck, and hit it with your feet.
You just plant it right there on the wall.
And basically you're just hanging off the side for a nanosecond before you use the momentum to pull yourself up with your arms and jump the rest of the way onto the next parking deck.
Yeah, very cat-like. It's used to get onto a higher object than you're currently on, and it's a good way.
That's much, much better put.
The roll, very common. You've seen stunt guys do this forever. They jump off a building onto a lower building, and they always, you know, to absorb the shock on their legs, they tuck and roll.
They absorb it in their shoulder instead.
Exactly. Tuck and roll, cover the head, pop back up, and keep going, because it's all about forward movement with parkour.
Yeah.
Whereas I would jump off, I would land, probably break my ankle, vomit, and then like lay there until somebody found me. That's what Chuck would do. My favorite, as you know, is the Kong Vault.
Well, the Kong Vault's the coolest.
It's the coolest. It looks like what apes do in the jungle. You run up on, let's say, a wall, and you leap forward, and you push yourself off with your hands.
Plant with your hands.
And don't let your legs touch at all, and just follow on through, and there's double Kong rolls where you tap twice. There's triples.
There's even...
We saw a quadruple in a gym.
So basically, when your hand is touching that wall, your body is laid out behind you.
It's like you're diving toward it almost.
Exactly. But you have like your two hands about just a little ahead of your shoulders, and then right when your hands touch, you bring your legs up basically through your chest and the wall, and then you just bound away. You vault away, hence the name Kong Vault.
Looks very animal-like. And one of the
very cool
early practitioners said that he noticed that it's like witnessing an animal in the jungle. Very aggressive.
That's one of the goals of parkour, is that you can basically move as quickly and fluidly as an animal.
Yeah.
And instinctually, too, is what I understand. I will never know that sensation.
No.
But it's what I understand is the goal.
You got the precision jump, which is pretty easy. It's basically like a standing broad jump.
You just jump from one place to another.
Yeah, but that's if, like, I want to jump on that little 2-foot section of wall. Like, you don't have the benefit of a roll because there's nothing else there.
Yeah. And then the speed vault.
Yeah, that's easy.
That's basically
I
like
probably
how,
do that.
How any kid has ever jumped, like, a chain link fence. You just put one hand down and throw your feet the opposite side over. And I guess with parkour, the difference is that you're doing this much more quickly.
Yes, and you keep running, and those are just a handful of moves. There are many, many more Gymkata-like moves that you can do, like side wall runs and sliding, and people now are doing those little half flips, adding a little flair to it. I guess the free runners are pretty cool.
Chuck, let's say that you are listening to this. You're like, I have tons of upper body strength. I'm 18 or older. And
I have no regard for my own well-being.
Right, and I'm really interested in this. Where would one go to find out more about parkour or to learn parkour?
You'd go to a jam.
Well, that's one place.
It's when they get together and hit the streets. But if you want to learn, like I said, you can go to there's gyms all over the country now.
There's academies where you can,
sure,
you can pay. If you go to parkour.com/groups, you can look up basically people who are doing it in your area.
Yeah.
And that's probably one of the most recommended ones, especially if you don't have any cash to shell out, because you're going to learn in the context of other people who know parkour, more than you do.
Sure.
And so you'll learn. You'll learn safety as well, but you'll be challenged too. And then, yes, there's academies as well. There's videos everywhere.
Everywhere.
YouTube has at least 6 different channels, according to parkour.com, of just parkour videos. And basically you want to wear a helmet at all times. You want to wear knee pads and one of those big sumo guy suits.
I don't see parkour people wearing any of that stuff.
No. Well, I'm COA, beginners, dude.
Okay.
COA.
Yeah, beginners, you should always do that.
Oh, also, I should have probably mentioned at the beginning of this that by downloading this episode and pressing play, you immediately forfeited any rights to sue us or any of our parent companies.
Yeah, be careful out there.
Yeah.
You know what my goal in life should be? I want to do a successful Kong leap.
That is not going to happen.
I want to do that, dude.
I will watch you try.
I'm fast.
I will watch you try anytime.
I'm a lot faster than you would think.
Let's go right now.
I get these little legs pumping, and I get my upper body leaning in the right direction.
Okay.
And it's pretty funny. Emily
I will watch you.
Emily remarks about my cat-like speed for a guy with a few extra pounds on him.
Okay. I want to see this.
I'm going to learn this.
Okay.
We're going
to watch you practice, too.
I don't want to just see the
final result.
I'm going to perfect it.
I want to see everything leading up to that.
No, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to learn it in secret, and then next time we're in New York, I'm just going to bust it out one day, and you're going to be like,
so
holy
surprising.
Crap, Chuck just did a Kong leap.
That would be very surprising. I look forward to that day.
All right, me too.
If you want to learn more about parkour, type in P-A-R-K-O-U-R. Not with the C, because then it wouldn't be down with the street. Into the search bar at howstuffworks.com. And I said search bar. I didn't say handy. Either way, it still brings up listener mail.
That's right, Josh. We're going to call this, and the winner is... Because you and I have to decide. Did you get this from Matt from England? He and his wife? The twisted couple? This is great.
I hate it when you put me on the spot like this.
It's okay. I know you read it. Hey guys, flipping great podcast. I love it. I'm a watch commander in the fire service here in Leeds, England, and my wife is an A&E nurse.
It's an entertainment nurse.
I think that's emergency room in England, maybe. I'm guessing, because she sees some weird stuff. Right now, we have always tried to tirelessly one-up one another at the end of each shift, which with the worst story of the day, because they both see odd things.
Odd and horrific.
Generally, we tie on things like car wrecks, fires, burn victims, suicides. And by the way, I'm acutely aware of how sick this is, but it's the spice that keeps our particular chili going. That's what he says.
Wow.
The only ones... He's talking shop about work.
Sure.
Basically. The ones we really compete with are the extra disgusting ones. So here's a conundrum. On the last tour, I was sure I had a winner. We had to assist a morbidly obese gentleman from his house onto an ambulance gurney. Upon moving his portly frame, I felt something land on my leg. Jerry's getting grossed out already. I couldn't initially see what it was because my hands and face were pressed firmly into the mushy flesh at the time, but I could hear the intakes of breath and gipping noises from the firefighters on my shift. I don't even know what a gipping noise is. On inspection, it turned out that 9 inches of this man's intestines were draped over my wet legs. Stuck for what to do in such an instance, should I push it back in, carry it with me, tuck it into his pocket? I opted to shuffle with him to his to the ambulance gently peel it free from my leg and set it beside him, making sure to break the awkward silence with, "Here you go, mate. You better take this with you. Regardless of this incident, I was sure I had my wife beat, and then she hits me with this. A guy walked into her triage department, pulled his pants down, and had the tail of a fish sticking out of his rear end. Evidently, it had been frozen and then thawed out. I get the feeling this was one of those Doc, it was a million to one chance type of things. And when it thawed out, the bones splayed out and it became stuck inside of his butt. So, boys, I need your help. Which one wins? Which is worse?
Chuck, this is much like comparing apples to oranges. In some ways, they're similar. They're both roundish. They're both fruits. But then they have many distinctions. The apple's skin is smooth. The orange is speckled. Mm-hmm. The orange is orange-colored. The apple is generally red, although it can be yellowish or green.
Yeah.
You never see an orange apple, I guess is my point. I'm going to say that while they're both extremely interesting, both entirely gruesome, the fish story is far too comical to win this one, in my opinion. I think the man's intestines coming out and having to be put back in by hand with a gentle, here you go, mate, is by far the winner.
I agree. I feel like Judge John Hodgman all of a sudden.
Yeah.
We render our verdict, and we're going with you, Matt. You are the winner. Matt in Leeds, England, congratulations for enduring the intestine on your leg.
Yes. Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and that makes This Stuff You Should Know kind of a special edition, really. We don't usually, like, hop on news stories.
Yeah, you can't ignore this stuff.
And I guess probably releasing something like a full week after it happens
is
not hopping on, but
right.
Still.
No, it's people have concerns, and there's a lot of information flying around. Everyone's trying to explain this thing in the simplest terms, and since that's what we do for a living,
yeah,
we figure we should do it.
Yes, so that's what we're doing today. We're going to talk about nuclear meltdowns and how it pertains to the crisis in Japan, right?
Yeah, and it's a lot more basic and simple than I thought.
Yeah,
I was
here.
Intimidated going into this, and then I was like, oh, well, that's not too hard to understand.
Yeah, it is nuclear science, but it's kind of approachable nuclear science.
Agreed.
So, Chuck, let's talk about catastrophe modeling.
Okay.
It's a type of risk modeling that insurance companies love. It's how they figure out why your insurance should be less than, say, somebody else of the same age, weight, height,
right,
that kind of thing, who lives in California, right?
Right. My former self.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can actually take a catastrophe model, right, and plug in every variable you can think of. And what you'll spit out is basically a curve, a graph of probability,
sure,
of an accident happening.
Right.
And then say, like, the level of damage that will happen.
Okay.
Okay? So if you do this over, like, say, a 10,000-year catalog, you can figure out how often, say, a 9.0 earthquake is going to hit Japan.
Gotcha.
And you can figure that out by choosing a probability.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say there's 4% probability of a 9.0 happening.
Okay.
You can find that that pops up maybe 40 times over a 10,000-year scale.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have then is that that's a 1 in 250-year probability.
Okay. That's where they get the predictor?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why power plants are – that's how they're built to withstand something like a once in a 250-year quake.
Saying it could happen in this area, so we need to account for it.
Right, and it's based on the dynamics, the geophysical dynamics of an earthquake of a 9.0 magnitude, right?
Right.
Because you've got all that plugged into the model.
Mm-hmm.
You figure out how bad it's going to be, how often it's going to happen, and then you build accordingly. And these the plants on the north coast of Japan, the TEPCO's Tokyo Electric Power Company, right?
Right.
They're Daiichi and Daini plants, number one and number two plants in Fukushima, were built to withstand a 250-year quake, which is exactly what they got on March 11th.
Yeah, they were, and they withstood it.
They did. Everything went fine.
Uh-huh. They shut down the reactors, mm-hmm, which is what's supposed to happen. Toot sweet.
But the problem was it withstood an earthquake, a huge earthquake, possibly the most massive earthquake that's ever hit Japan. But it didn't withstand the tsunami. This model, whatever the model it was built for, did not predict the tsunami. It
right.
didn't take it into account. And that's why we have this crisis right now, right?
Yeah.
So we should probably also mention that the focus right now is on, this potential nuclear meltdown. But, the tsunami is up to, like, I think 15,000 dead and missing now, just from the tsunami alone.
Are they calculating the tsunami different from the earthquake, as far as that goes?
I read tsunami.
Okay.
So, possibly.
Because I read 7,000, but that might just be, maybe there's different numbers.
That could, no, I think that's just dead. This is like 15,000 dead and missing.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. But now, you've got an earthquake that just knocked down a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You have a tsunami that took out entire towns. And then you have this nuclear crisis that's unfolding. And, this is going to release in a few days, so we'll have to make do with the information that we have, right?
Yeah, unless something like really, really big happens between today, which is Thursday, and Tuesday, we might have to come back in and, like, doctor it up a bit.
Right.
But and this is what we're going with for now.
Yes. Yeah, so, Chuck, let's talk a little bit about how if you walk around a nuclear power plant, what are you going to find? What's going on there?
Well, it's pretty easy, actually. And this is something that I didn't know because I didn't know a whole lot about nuclear power at all
right.
until this happened. And basically what a nuclear power plant does is it creates one of the oldest models for creating energy, which is steam-powered turbines.
Right.
And how they do that, they basically use nuclear fuel, which these days is enriched uranium.
Mm-hmm.
The uranium atom split creates a lot of heat. Neutrons flying around also is created by that process.
Right.
And this heat boils water in the case of these reactors. These are water boiling reactors. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about more of the Mark I here in a minute. And it produces, basically it boils this water, produces steam. That steam drives a turbine. Generates power, about a gigawatt of electricity at full power, which is a lot.
Right, and that is a tremendous amount. And at full power, the heat that's being put out, Marshall, who wrote a really cool, he's the founder of the site.
He can see, he's still got it.
Yes, he does. He wrote a very incredible article in record time called How Japan's Nuclear Crisis Works. But he said that this puts out the heat that's akin to about a billion watt bulb. When
yeah.
it's at full power.
It's hot.
The thing is, obviously, you don't always need your nuclear reactors to be running at full power.
No.
So what you do is you modulate how much heat is being put out by using what are called control rods.
Yeah, it's sort of like the throttle on your gas.
Right. A control rod is basically something like maybe a boron-enriched length of metal that is inserted into the fuel rod core. Right? And if you pull it out a little bit, then it heats up. If you push it in a little bit, it heats down. So, and by heat, I guess I could say it powers up and it powers down, right?
Yeah, because it's attracting the neutrons.
Right.
Neutrons are what basically make the splitting of the atom happen. And that's the problem there is it's self-sustaining. So if you didn't have these control rods, it becomes, its own living reaction.
Well,
it would just keep going.
It would keep going as long as you could keep it cool. It'd just be running at max power all the time.
Yeah.
Right. Now, when an earthquake hits, one of the fail safes designed into any nuclear reactor is that the control rods are going to get jammed in all the way, which is called scramming. And when the reactor is scrammed, all the control rods are shut down.
Yeah.
Or all the fuel
sure.
rods are shut down because there's these control rods just accepting all the neutrons. And like you said, the neutrons are the active ingredient in nuclear fission because they're just making all the atoms
yeah.
in the surrounding area unstable, right?
Yeah. But it's important to point out that even when they're fully inserted and it's shut down, it's still creating heat.
And here's the problem.
Small amount of heat, but it's enough heat if left unchecked to potentially cause what's called a meltdown.
Right. So this heat that you're talking about, Chuck, is called decay heat.
Yeah.
And I've read places where it lasts a week. I've read that it lasts for a year. And I think it actually lasts for a year. It takes a year for a fuel rod to actually shut down, to go to a cold shutdown state.
Wow.
Where, like, it doesn't need to be cooled any longer with water, right?
Wow.
So when you scram something like they did on March 11th, it's not just going to cool down right away. And that's the problem that we're dealing with right now is this decay heat, which, like you said, is still, it's a ridiculous amount of heat. and it requires tons of cooling, right?
Yes.
Which normally should be fine because the Daiichi plant with reactors 1 through 4 have cooling systems and lots of them, right?
Yeah, it's a closed loop. So what happens is the water boils and creates a lot of pressure. The pressure is released via steam. And the steam actually gets cooled, condensed, and reused like right. a closed-loop air conditioning system.
Sure.
Not a whole lot different. And the water is recirculated. That water is recirculated back through the system with these electric pumps.
Right.
And those electric pumps are the key to keeping everything cool. And the problem, we'll get to the problem. They have a lot of fail-safes in place because, you know, they don't just plug the pump into the wall and say, all right, we're good to go.
Right.
Because that would be bad if the power went down. There are backup electric pumps. There are backup... If the power goes down, you can actually... Because I believe it's using its own nuclear power to operate
right.
these pumps
this
at
is
first.
This is an electricity-generating nuclear power plant,
so
right?
So it's running itself. But
right.
once the plant shuts down, which is what they did, they say, okay, we can grab electricity from the grid.
Right.
But the grid shut down.
Yes, that earthquake shut the grid down too. Pretty much right after the control rods were scrammed into the reactors.
So they have another backup. They're like, all right, we got these diesel generators are great. They do a great job. Tsunami comes in, water on top of diesel generators makes them to not operate.
Yeah, they were submerged. They weren't designed to operate in submerged conditions.
And then they said, all right, we've got all these backups in place. The final backup we have is a battery system.
Yeah.
Battery system kicked in. It worked great. But the problem is it only works for a little bit of, you know, like how many hours? I don't know if it said.
A few.
Several hours.
Yeah.
Because the idea is that the battery system is in dire emergency until you get the grid back going, which shouldn't take that long.
Right. Now, also... transportation was knocked out. Supply routes are knocked out.
Yeah.
There's no power.
They tried to get more diesel generators there, but they just couldn't get them in time.
Right. So we have a nuclear power plant without power to run these cooling systems. And these are boiled water reactors, which means that the water, you know, like you said, Chuck, it gets its energy or it creates electricity by boiling water.
Yeah.
Now, these fuel rods are so hot, even with this decay heat, that the moment water hits them, even boiling water, the boiled water is keeping them cool. They're so hot.
Yeah.
They just have to remain underwater. Let's just keep them underwater. That's the key.
Uh-huh.
The problem is they create tons of steam, and that steam is what runs the turbine, and then after it exits the turbine, like you said, it's condensed and then reused as coolant, right?
Right.
But if those pumps aren't working, all it's doing is producing steam, boiling off water, and basically getting rid of the only coolant source they have.
Yeah, and if water gets hot enough, it actually, something called thermolysis takes place, and that's when it breaks down into constituent hydrogen and oxygen atoms,
yep.
or in this case, hydrogen gas,
right.
which is really, really explosive.
And that's actually a pretty normal byproduct of even like the proper functioning of a boiled water reactor plant.
Yeah.
So they have procedures in place to vent steam normally, but they burn the hydrogen off in a slow, controlled burn
right.
when they're venting it
right.
to reduce radioactivity and to, you know, keep explosions from happening.
Sure.
Now, you may be wondering, why would they design a system that uses water to cool and nothing else?
Right.
The point, the whole reason that somebody ever designed the Mark I or boiled water reactor is that it actually has a failsafe built in. The fact that it uses water as a coolant and what's called a neutron modulator,
right.
which keeps that thing from going like out of control past, you know, just a sustained max power nuclear fission,
right.
is whatever you're using as a neutron modulator or moderator, I'm sorry. So as long as the neutron moderator there, you can have fission, nuclear fission.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can't get the control rods in time,
right.
and the coolant goes away, the fuel actually won't be able to continue in a fission state because the neutron moderator is not there.
Right.
So you don't have the coolant, but at least you don't have a meltdown from nuclear fission,
right.
which is really horrible, right? So that's why they have this boiled water reactor. But the problem is this water served as a failsafe and its Achilles heel.
And in this case, Josh, the hydrogen gas we were talking about, the normal reaction, got worse because the water boiled away. These fuel tubes were now exposed to air.
Right.
They got really, really hot and started cracking. And the little uranium fuel pellets, I think they're the size of a Tootsie Roll, is
mm-hmm.
that right?
Mm-hmm.
They overheated and cracked and allowed water to get in there, and water's not supposed to be in there.
No.
And that's where you had this massive hydrogen gas explosion.
Right.
And I think, was it one of them?
Yeah, reactor
or
four.
Or two of them. I think it was several different reactors had this explosion within the reactor building itself. It wasn't like the whole thing exploded. It was contained within the building.
They hope. They think.
Right.
Not really.
Exactly. So we're still getting news at this point because there's a small number of people, you know, on the ground.
Right.
And they're not all, like, on the phone with Anderson Cooper.
Right.
So the information on the inside isn't that readily available right now.
So there were several explosions, Chuck. I think it was like reactors 1 and 3 had explosions from this hydrogen gas. They were venting it. They didn't burn it off properly.
Right.
And the hydrogen built up and up and up. And remember, you know, you need to keep these things wet. You have to keep them underwater,
mm-hmm.
under any circumstances whatsoever. They have to be cool constantly. They have to remain underwater. So without these backup generators, without the battery power generators, without their normal electricity, without anything,
uh-huh.
they finally decide we need to flood these things with seawater, boron-enriched seawater. And it was
yeah.
a chemical reaction between the seawater and the hydrogen that caused these explosions.
Oh, it was?
Yeah. Which, we should say, this is very, 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 very important. That was a conventional chemical explosion, right?
Yeah, it was not a nuclear bomb.
Right. It's not possible for a nuclear reactor to blow up like in a nuclear explosion. It's not possible.
The danger, like with Chernobyl and anything, is leaking radiation. It's not like a Hiroshima type of event.
Right. So that happens. To create a nuclear bomb, what you have to do is take radioactive material that in a subcritical state, which is like what you might have in your front pocket right now, Chuck.
Right.
Right? It's just plain old lump of uranium. Who cares, right?
Right.
And you have to explode it so fast to create a chain reaction that uses up all of that subcritical material that it skips over the critical stage and goes right into supercritical.
Right.
The precision that requires makes it that there's probably like 5 people on the planet right now that know how to build a nuclear bomb like that.
Right.
You can't just do that with fuel. The big threat is the melting of the fuel, right?
Right. And so they flooded it with seawater, which ruins the reactors forever, by
right.
the way, we should mention. But that's a better scenario. And apparently these are 40-year-old reactors that were not on its last legs as far as they were about to break, but they were near the end of their operating lifespan.
Do you want to hear something horrible?
No.
Reactor number 1 went online on March 25th, 1971.
Uh-huh.
So it should have been decommissioned on March 25th, 2011.
Oh, really? There was actually a date?
There should have been, but apparently TEPCO applied for and received a 10-year extension on its operating licenses for those.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, what we have some information here. What does this all mean to the world at large?
Well, here's the big problem. Like we said, the fuel isn't going to explode, but it's going to melt, right? And you said, Chuck, that these little fuel pellets in the fuel rods are like the size of a Tootsie Roll.
Yeah.
And about the shape, right? If it melts, when this stuff hits air, it begins to melt. And if it melts, it will no longer be able to be cooled because it's going to be a big flat, dense glob of nuclear fuel that's melting.
And collecting inside of this containment vessel.
Right. So the operative word is containment vessel.
Right.
This extremely hot nuclear fuel that's forming a pool can conceivably melt through the containment vessel.
Yeah.
And once that happens, when it encounters the concrete barrier, this which is like the fail-safe of fail-safes, it should not be able to melt through that. It's possible it could, and if it does, then you have nuclear fuel in the environment.
Yeah.
And that's when it's beyond catastrophe level.
Yeah, and that's a containment vessel that's completely functional and intact, and we don't know what kind of damage these explosions have caused. They might be compromised from the inside
mm-hmm.
to make containment even more difficult.
Right.
Who knows at this point?
So the explosions were kind of jarring, you could say, right? the explosions at reactors 1 and 3.
Yes.
There was a fire at reactor 4. But apparently one of the big problems is a bunch of spent fuel that's no longer being cooled at reactor 2. And when this fuel melts, it can catch on fire. So vapor is bad enough.
Right.
But if it catches fire, smoke is what's really going to get you. It will create and carry further radioactive particles. Mm-hmm. That has a much longer half-life than the stuff that's going to come out in the vapor.
Right.
That's the threat.
That's a big threat.
It is a big threat.
So we mentioned that it was the Mark I boiling water reactor that was over there. GE made these, General Electric, in the 1960s. They went online in, I think, 71, you said?
Yes.
Which is a long time ago. The United States has 23 of these reactors right now at 16 locations. Including Oyster Creek in New Jersey, Dresden near Chicago, Monticello near Minneapolis. No reason to freak out right now because, well, here's the deal. These Mark I boilers are under scrutiny right now. The New York Times ran a piece about these apparently in 1972, right after they built these things. They identified weaknesses and said, hey, we should discontinue this because... there's some safety risks. One of the safety risks was a smaller containment design, which they said in 1972 might be more susceptible to explosion and rupture from a buildup of hydrogen.
Wow.
So that seems to be what happened here in Japan. Obviously, GE's not on the hook or anything. They, you know, once you take control of your nuclear power plant as a nation, it's yours. And it's not like you can call up GE and say, hey, jerks, you know, what about all this? So Japan was responsible for, you know, care and upkeep of their own thing. And apparently the Mark I's in the United States have undergone a lot of modifications over the years, one of which is a change to the Taurus, which is a water-filled vessel that encircles the primary containment vessel. So there's all these things in place in the 70s and 80s that the U.S. put in place at our Mark I's that they say will prevent something like this. I don't know what was going on in Japan, if they were modified at all over the years. I'm sure that'll all come out.
Well, apparently,
at some point.
It's starting to. Apparently, some at least one GE engineer for the Mark I resigned because he thought the Mark I was so flawed, and apparently GE wasn't doing anything about it.
This was in the early 70s?
Yeah, but some GE whistleblowers blew the whistle on the Fukushima plant. Because apparently they falsified records before.
Really?
They used dishonest practices in monitoring their own radioactive output.
Right.
And there was a lack safety culture, basically, by the company's own admission.
This is interesting to see what ramifications is going to have on nuclear power, because there was a pretty good track record for a couple of decades, and a lot of people...
It's starting to come around again.
Well, yeah, and saying this is actually a green... fuel producing technology because it doesn't produce carbon, and we got a good track record and it's pretty safe now, and these things are like super safe. They can withstand all these different things. What they couldn't withstand was a combination in Japan's case of these things,
right?
Like earthquakes and tsunamis.
Well, Chuck, it had a good 20-year run where it was starting to like gain traction again. Nuclear power was,
yeah,
because it was trying to emerge from the shadow of Three Mile Island, right? The partial fuel melt, which is the correct term. Meltdown is not actually used in the industry, we should say.
Oh, really?
Yeah, but partial fuel melt in 1979 in Pennsylvania.
That's right. And that was, like you said, Three Mile Island, which is categorized as a level 5 mm-hmm. Disaster.
Which had local consequences. It was like the fuel melted and pooled,
right?
But it didn't escape the containment vessel, but some radioactive material was released into the surrounding area.
Right.
But it scared the tar out of everybody.
Yeah, well, China syndrome didn't help much.
Yeah, that's true too.
And so this disaster in Japan right now is categorized, I've seen it as a 6, mm-hmm. I've seen it as a 5, depending on who you ask. But either way, it's not a good situation, obviously.
Right. So what we do know is that as it stands right now, at least, it's not a Chernobyl. And Chernobyl was a level 7, which is as bad as it can get.
Yeah, and Chernobyl was a different scenario as well.
Definitely. So there were a lot of differences. Remember, we talked about water being a neutron modulator?
Yeah.
Well, Chernobyl's design used water as a coolant but had graphite as a neutron modulator. When their system failed, the graphite caught fire and spewed radioactive smoke, which you'll remember is the worst stuff to have, into the atmosphere for 10 days before they got a hold of it.
Yeah, and they also tried to keep it quiet, which isn't a wise move when you're talking nuclear meltdown.
No, it's not.
And by all indications, Japan has been very forthcoming.
Here or there.
Trying to get good information out. Oh, really?
They kept this. They kept the fire at Reactor 4
quiet
for enough hours that it ruined their credibility, basically.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so no one's quite sure. Plus, Japan's like, we just need a 12-mile radius between 12 miles, get out of there. 12 and 19 miles, seal up your home.
Right.
And the U.S. is like, we say 50 miles, and any American that shows up at Narita Airport gets a free flight out of here.
Really?
Yeah.
So the Japanese are probably saying, listen to the guys in America
right now. No, they're not broadcasting it.
Well, no.
No American stuff is getting broadcast over there.
Well, the citizens, if they knew this.
Right.
What about Facebook and social media?
I'm sure it's getting out like that, but apparently, like, the Japanese media is, they're known to not really criticize the government. It's just not their culture.
Yeah, I got a really good friend in Tokyo, and he's gone to Osaka right now with his family.
Mm-hmm.
Two small kids. He's not trying to be panicky.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also got two small kids, and he's just kind of playing it safe right now.
Right.
So we should talk about radiation, I guess.
Yeah, it's actually small kids that are at the biggest risk about this.
Always are.
With radiation, how do you measure radiation, Chuck?
You measure it, Josh, with a unit called a millisievert, and it measures the absorption into the human body specifically, not like how much is in the air. This is how much you are absorbing. How much is dangerous to you?
So you can measure it in millisievert or microsievert, but the one that's like when you get to one sievert, which would be 1,000 millisieverts or 1,000,000 microsieverts, that's when you are in big trouble immediately.
There's 1,000 microsieverts in a millisievert. And then how many millisieverts in a sievert?
1,000.
1,000.
Yeah.
Okay.
So one sievert, I think, gives you a 10% chance of dying in 30 days. And that's just bad. That's ridiculous exposure. I don't think anybody's recorded any levels like that, right?
Yeah. But let's put this into perspective. Right now they're saying you're probably hearing on the news, like 167 times the average annual dose that a human gets. Because we get radiation, I think Americans get 6.2 millisieverts a year through medical diagnostic procedures, dental x-rays.
Flying an airplane.
Smoking.
Yeah, going through those full body scanners.
Smoking 1.5 packs of cigarettes a day, 13 millisieverts per year.
I am radioactive.
Yeah, well, you're getting it out of your system, buddy.
Yes, I am, but I still probably am because radioactivity is cumulative, which is why they break it up into millisieverts per hour or millisieverts per year.
Right, right.
Because after a little bit of time, your body can process this stuff or the half-life of it is spent and it's not deadly any longer, right?
Right.
But the big problem is when it is still in full bore, a radioactive material, and it's absorbed through your skin. You can breathe it in. You can get it in through your tongue, your ears, your eyes, your hair, everywhere.
Yeah.
You can absorb this radioactive material. And apparently, one of the biggest threats, or the biggest known threat, is, like I said earlier, iodide-131, right?
Iodine, right?
Iodine-131.
So that's important because iodide is actually counteracts the effects of radiation, and people are snapping this up. Apparently, drugstore.com is sold out of iodide right now.
Right.
And
so
fake iodide is even being sold. There's warnings now about buying fake iodide.
I know, and people are eating iodized salt, and I think the salt council came out and said that's not going to do anything for you. The reason people are eating iodide and buying iodide salt tablets, which they should frankly be sending them to Japan. You don't need them here in the U.S. They actually do need them in Japan.
Yeah.
With iodine-131, it's a radioactive byproduct of nuclear fission, right?
Yeah.
Or uranium specifically. And when you absorb that, your thyroid gets this big, fat, heavy dose of it. And the thyroid is responsible for some very fast dividing cells. So once a cell is compromised in your thyroid, that radioactivity is going to spread like gangbusters through your body, especially if you're a kid, because you have faster than normal dividing cells anyway, right?
Yeah.
So that's why thyroid cancer tends to go up in cases of radioactive exposure.
Right.
If you take iodide, your thyroid actually is going to get as much iodide as it can, but it has a saturation level.
Right.
So if you expose it to iodide before you're exposed to radioactive iodine-131, your thyroid's going to be full up and be like, sorry, no more room for iodine here,
exactly.
Radioactive or otherwise.
Right.
And even better, iodine-131 has a half-life of 8 days. So all you have to do is basically make sure your thyroid's full of iodide for 8 days and you're set.
Right. And if you're worried here in the U.S., there's been stuff on the news about the radioactive plume crossing the ocean. Apparently the nuclear submarine, the Ronald Reagan, cruised right on through it the other day. And the material was removed with soap and water. And it's contamination-free. And they said basically this steam that's coming across the ocean is less dangerous than living in Denver, Colorado for a year. Because when you live at high altitudes, you have less atmosphere to block radiation. And just living in Denver, Colorado means you have more radiation than the average American.
Right. Plus,
but it's still a very small amount. So I'm not saying people in Denver shouldn't be like, oh, I need to move.
Yeah, right, exactly. They're also, that's not factoring in crime even. You get hit by a bus, you can get shot in Denver.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you're a smoker, if you go to the dentist and get your head x-rayed, it's like you get radioactive radioactivity as a human being, and a little more so as an American.
I think the media is fanning the flames of us losing our perspective as far as radiation hysteria goes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What else is there, Chuckers?
Well, this was just off the news wire about 20 minutes ago. They said that they have picked up some small amounts of radioactive material in Sacramento, but it was minuscule, is what they're saying, not harmful to human health. And so people on the West Coast don't need to be freaking out at this point, from what we can tell.
So
people in Japan should be worried, yeah. But they're even saying in Japan, like, you know, let's see what we can do here. You don't need to be leaving the country en masse.
Yes. If you hear a report that there is radiation coming our way, ask, what's the level? If it's in microsieverts, I would advise you not to worry. If it's in millisieverts, start to wonder exactly how many millisieverts. If it's 100 or less, then you are within EPA standards for radiation exposure. But you should probably consider maybe getting out of town for a little while. But I think maybe keeping a calm head and not buying up all the iodide tablets in the world is probably a good idea at this point.
Yeah, I got one more little factoid that's interesting for all the news agencies that are fanning the flames. Apparently, Grand Central Station, New York City, the granite there, and the uranium-laced stone used at the U.S. Capitol building supposedly give off enough radiation that they would not pass a nuclear power plant's licensing test. So they're pretty strict with the licensing. People walking around Grand Central Station aren't in danger of dying from nuclear radiation. So that just kind of puts it in perspective.
Or are they? I wish we had that Law and Order doo-doo to play.
Yeah, that was appropriate.
Well, I guess that's about it. Do you have anything else, Chuck?
No.
No? Okay. Hopefully you guys have a better understanding of what's going on there. I know I do. Our hearts and minds are with everybody in Japan. Keep thinking of them. Maybe send some money. Maybe
yeah.
Send some iodine.
Send some life straws. Apparently life straws are being sent over there in some of these rescue boxes.
Yes.
Kind of cool.
I saw that too. And there's always Red Cross, right?
Yes.
And I guess since that's about it. Oh, if you want to learn more, type in Japan's nuclear crisis in the handy search bar at howstuffworks.com. It will bring up just a really great overview of what's going on over there.
You've been listening to Josh and Chuck and the radio version of Stuff You Should Know. If you'd like to contact Josh or Chuck, you can email them at stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. To subscribe to the podcast of this show, go to the iTunes store and search for Stuff You Should Know. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
Tuned to the Downtown Soulville Show on WFMU. A little bit of a late start tonight because of some technical difficulties, but it's all under control now. You're in good hands. Soul 45s till 9.
And a high